Let's get underway this morning. Today we're going to start talking about the sort of the final big topic in the quantum theory course, and that is we're going to take a little bit of a look at quantum computing. Okay, so what is quantum computing? Well, in quantum computing, what we want to do is to exploit the quantum physics of some system to do information processing in some extremely good way, extremely powerful, efficient, unusual way. And that's the motivation behind quantum computing. And it's a fairly young branch of quantum theory.
Before we start, this thing being practical, I went to the Department of Electrical Engineering, worked at the university. They do lots of research on information theory and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, do you work on quantum information theory too? They said no, because it's not practical. No electrical engineering department works on that.
Well, actually, that's not true.
Is that?
No big one.
You see, Stanford, for example, works on. Yeah.
No.
Stanford's pretty.
I'm aware of prominent information theory research groups all over the world, and the papers, and our most top journal, which is IEEE. No information theory paper I've seen in those. And I wanted to ask, is it really, getting in progress, and is it really practical, or it's just something we look at for the future, maybe distant future?
Okay, I'll tell you my story. I have a bet, and the bet is with Raymond Lafong, who's the head of the IQC over at the University of Waterloo, though he wasn't when we made the bet. And the bet is whether by July 14th, 2019, which is 20 years from the date of the bet, there would exist an actual quantum computer that would have either factored a 500-bit number or done a computation of equal difficulty. That's the bet. And the value of the bet is a bottle of port from 1999. So if you're very confident about your side of the bet, then you don't bother buying your bottle of port. But if you are worried about it, then you buy it early when it's cheap so that you can pay it off. Now, in this bet, I took the optimistic side. I said, those experimentalists, they're terribly clever. And they keep un-gedankening the Gedanken experiments. And so I bet yes, they would. But I bought my bottle of port, and it's sitting on the shelf in my lab gathering dust. I recently asked Raymond if he'd bought his bottle of port. Now, he's the director of the IQC, and he said, no. The upshot is that either way, we're going to win. Because if it's possible, then it's a big deal for him because of his, what he does for a living, that would be a great thing. He's working as hard as anybody to make sure he loses his bet. And if it doesn't work, then at least I've got my bottle of port, and I can pay it off without much ado. That, of course, is an amusing story. But in fact, I think the significance of quantum computing is not primarily, at this stage, the practicality of quantum computers. Now, many of my friends might say differently. They say quantum computers would be terribly important if they're practical. But I think that the important thing is that it's changed the way we look at the dynamics of the quantum world. And quantum computing suggests new problems, brings to bear powerful methods from other subjects like computer science, and just in general, is part of a larger revolution in physics in which information concepts are becoming primary. So I think quantum computing's real significance, certainly for the next decade, at least until 2019, is going to be in it as a blindingly illuminating theoretical concept. Now, it may also be that it's just simply very, very difficult to build a quantum computer. So, for example, if you go back to the 19th century, you run into the chap Charles Babbage. He was an English mathematician who basically invented all of the modern ideas of computing, of the fundamental ideas, you know, of stored program computing and so on. But his idea for doing this was mechanical. It was gears and levers and cams and things like this. And so he invested decades of his life and bucket loads of money to try to construct the analytical and difference engines, the things that he had in his head. And he failed because the machine tool technology of the day simply was not up to the task. Okay? You couldn't make things that were precise enough and didn't have that were not limited by friction and things like that. You just couldn't do it. And so his analytical engine was never built in his lifetime. It turned out that all of his ideas were good ideas, but the physical implementation of his ideas had to wait for many decades until the invention of electronics. So the physical substrate for the ideas was completely different from his original effort. It was based on physics that he never knew, that he never saw. So was his effort useless? No. His effort was terribly important. First of all, the effort to try to make an analytical engine actually spurred a lot of practical development of machine tool technology, which was useful in all kinds of things. There were lots of mechanical calculators of various sorts that were not Babbage's analytical engine, but were descendants of his ideas. And secondly, all of his ideas were right and were eventually implemented in a new technology later on. It may be that all of the current schemes for trying to do practical quantum computing, it may be that all of them will amount to Babbage's wheels, Babbage's gears. That they are ideas that are in principle ideas, that we may learn a lot and in fact develop a lot of really important practical technology in the effort to achieve quantum computing along those lines. But quantum computing, if it is ever implemented, will be implemented using completely different kinds of physics. So that's sort of my take on the current state. Now, electrical engineers, there is quantum computing research done within reasonably well-known electrical engineering departments. Heck, there's some quantum computing research done in mechanical engineering departments. Seth Lloyd at MIT is a professor of mechanical engineering, quantum mechanical engineering, presumably. But in fact, for now, all the really, really interesting computations are theoretical. Early quantum computing meetings, some of them were held in Turin, Italy. As you know, Turin, Italy is a great automobile manufacturing center for Italy. And I thought this was very appropriate. And in fact, we should call quantum computers Turin machines. Because like the other kind of Turin machines, they're often made by Fiat. Okay, very good. Okay, so if I answer your question, this, I don't know if this is a full-throated defense of quantum computing. I think that it's absolutely a worthwhile subject. The practicalities of it, in fact, I hope to address a little bit in one circumstance, on Friday. But for now, I want to develop the subject. Okay? So is that a proper response at the outset? Okay. So let me tell you about this first by developing an abstract model of quantum computing, and then later talking about challenges to practically implementing it. And before that, I want to give a little prehistory. And this prehistory is for another kind of computing, which is just as theoretical as quantum computing, but it's completely classical. So prehistory, that's, of course, a classical prehistory. Okay. And the question was, if computation is a physical process, if we always accomplish our computation by means of the dynamical evolution of some system, which we do, then what can we say about the basic physical properties of that process? Can we say anything really, really fundamental about computational processes? For example, is there a fundamental amount of heat that must be dissipated in a computation? And this is a serious question, because if you ever, used a laptop, especially an old one, on your actual lap, okay, you know that computations dissipate heat, right? And in fact, getting rid of the heat is in some ways the major design barrier for more powerful computers. Do you know why the components of a chip are only a few layers deep on the chip? I mean, we could build them deeper in silicon. The reason is you need a direction for the heat to flow. The things are dissipating heat all the time. So the question is, what's the basic amount? And back like in the 1950s, not 1590s, that literally would be prehistory. 1950s, there was this idea around that maybe it took kT times the log of 2 per bit operation. If you did, if you added a couple of bits or took their OR or their NAND or something, then you'd have to dissipate kT log 2. And the arguments for this, or something like that, the arguments for this were extremely hand-wavy. And so about 50 years ago, Rolf Landauer at IBM took the question seriously and did a very sophisticated analysis of actual physical models of computation, how the computation might be done. And he said, look, you can make the computation go slowly, and you can eliminate things like the fact in electrical circuits, very often when you run a charge from one place to another, you have a resistive loss. But if you run the computation half as fast, the current's half as low, half as strong, the power dissipation is only one quarter as big. It goes for twice as long, it takes twice as long to transfer the charge, but that still saves you a factor of 2 in the amount of heat that you dissipate in the course of moving the charge from here to there if you just go slow. So he says, well, so how well can you do? And Landauer proved that the only thermodynamically irreversible steps, are logically irreversible ones. What do I mean? When I mean thermodynamically irreversible, I mean necessarily thermodynamically irreversible. Nobody can prevent you from making your computer less efficient than this. But this is the limit. So what do I mean? What are some examples? Well, one example would be just negation. I take a bit and I change it to the opposite bit. That is, and what I mean by that is, that 0 goes to 1 and 1 goes to 0. And I can reverse it. All I have to do is do it again, right? I can reverse it. So this could be done reversibly. But here's one that's not reversible. Let's talk about erasure. I take a bit and I turn it to zero. And over here I'm thinking that zero goes to zero and one also goes to zero. Something like that. And that's irreversible. That must be accompanied by a loss of by a dissipation of heat, a dumping of entropy in the environment, and the cost for erasure, according to Landauer, is kT log 2 per bit. Okay, this is a bit operation that doesn't have any thermodynamic cost in principle. This is a bit operation that does have a thermodynamic cost in principle, and so on. Basically, in an irreversible operation, you have two or more states of the computer memory that all go to the same state. Okay, you have two or more states. Is it the M equals memory state? Two or more states of the computer's memory, which go to the same state. And this is logically irreversible because if you're presented with a computer here, you don't know how to go back to the way it was. The information's not there anymore. And so these are computations that do this are irreversible. And they're the only ones that have necessary thermodynamic irreversibility. Okay, so that's kind of cool. Then, that was like 50 years ago, that's early 1960s. And then, considerably later, Charles Bennett, also at IBM, showed basically that any computation, except erasure, can be done reversibly. He showed how to do reversible computation. And after Bennett's work, and Bennett and others spent a long time trying to think of actual physical models of reversible computation. Okay, with like billiard balls running down pipes and running into each other. They were all kooky. But the idea, but what they were for is to show that you could, in principle, realize Bennett's reversible computation. Now the reversible computation, you might need to keep some extra bits. In other words, you might have to hang on to a record of your computation as you go. You might fill up some buffer of memory. But actually, it turns out you don't have to keep very much. You don't have to keep very much. So let's suppose we want to compute the function f on the input a. And f might be a function that has values 0 or 1, so you store it in a bit. A might be a whole string of bits. So I want to compute some function on this string of bits. This string of bits represents an integer. I want to find out if the integer is prime. Okay? And so f is 1 if it's prime and 0 if it's composite. That's an example. Okay? And so here's what you might do. You start out with a, then a whole bunch of zeros, and then another zero. And these are registers of the computer. And this is the input. And this is the workspace of the computer, and here's the output of the computer. Okay, and then you do something really long and hard and complicated, and in the workspace you've done the computation. But along the way, you've got a whole bunch of garbage. You've got, you know, x and y and so on. But there in the workspace is the answer that you want. So you've accumulated a lot of garbage. You've accumulated a lot of garbage. And who wants that? So here's what you do. You then copy the answer to the output. So what you do is you take the value of this and you copy it over to here. You copy it over to here. Okay? A, x, y, f of a, f of a. Okay? And now you run the computer backwards. This is a reversible computation, so you actually reverse it. You run it step by step in reverse. And what does that do? What does that do? Well, that computation never involved the output bit. It turns all of these guys back to zero and leaves that guy A. That's possible. We can undo the computation. And so it turns out that the only bits that you actually really need to keep in the long run is the input. If you keep the input around, then the output can be gotten. And this can be reversed, right? So I run this computation forward, and then I can, well, this is kind of funny, I can uncopy. I got to talk about uncopying here in a minute. What do I mean by uncopying? That's kind of weird. And then I can run it back here. So what do I mean by what about this uncopying? I've got this thing here. A zero going to a f of a. That's really what's happening here. There's some work bits, but they go back to zero. But I want to make sure this is a reversible computation. So what happens if I have some other state of the computer memory? If I have A, but instead of zero in the output, I have a one. What does that go to? What does that go to? It's got to go to something different. It's got to go to something different. It's got to go to something different for every value of A. All right? And one way of doing that is to make sure that if there's a 1 here, it goes to A and the complement of f of A. That is to say, I could write this way, that A, B is my output now, that goes to A times, or A, not times, but A with B plus f of A, where this is addition modulo 2. Addition modulo 2. So that if f of a is 0, this is just b. And if f of a is 1, this is just b bar. And that does exactly this. That does exactly this. And so it's reversible. And you can see that this copying business is a very simple computation like that, except the value f is just f. So the copy operation that I had would take this to x, right? This is what I wanted, but I can express that this way as a reversible computation that x y goes to x and y plus x. And the great thing about this is, if I do it twice, I restore the original state. Because that would then go to x, y plus x plus x, but any bit added to itself, modulo 2, is 0. And so this is just x, y. So that's the sense in which you can uncopy. That's the sense in which you can uncopy. All right? All this has a point. All this is going to come up later. So this is kind of neat. This is kind of neat. That's a reversible way, and I know that in order to do the thing reversibly, all I need to do is keep the input as well as the output, and I could do any computation with arbitrarily little dissipation of heat. Now, we're really far away from that. Even in extremely efficient computation, we're really far from that. However, we get closer to that all the time as a kind of Moore's law approach to energy per computational cycle. And it's done by you can make the very efficient computation by doing it kind of slowly, so you keep a quasi-static equilibrium situation, and by making sure you're not doing any irreversible logical steps. Yeah.
So is that taken into designs of new efficient computers?
Well, there's always a trade-off, because if you just tremendously underclock your processor, it actually works a lot more efficiently. So the guys at TI have done a lot with this, where they actually take special versions of rather ordinary processors, and they run them at low temperatures and very slowly, and they can get the amount of energy dissipated per computational step very low. So there's always a trade-off between speed and dissipation, most people like speed. However, if you want to put a lot of computation in a small volume, you really have to pay attention to the heat dissipation, because you have to get the heat out somehow. Ralph Merkle, was it Ralph Merkle? You know, it might not have been Ralph Merkle. I think it was Ralph Merkle. He gave a talk one time where he just said, well, suppose we used our chip making process to make a solid processor, you know, 1 cubic centimeter of stuff that was just all logic gates, packed into a volume, not in a thin layer, but in a volume. He says, okay, he calculated the incredible computational power, more powerful than all the computers in the world put together and stuff like this, right? And then he calculated the heat dissipation if you turned it on, using the current technology. And he discovered that what he had designed, this computronium, what he had designed was, in fact, a high-grade explosive. Okay? So this heat dissipation question in the physics of computation has been very significant. And even though we have never built a reversible computer, and we are still quite a ways from the Landauer limit, nevertheless, it's been extremely useful to think about this. Okay, so much for prehistory. Let's get to the real thing here. I'm having too much fun. I got to stop having fun here. Okay. All right. Let's talk about quantum computing. Quantum computing began to be developed in the early 1980s. And there were three people who were sort of most associated with the development of the idea of a quantum computer. And they all sort of worked independently. So here we go, here, quantum computing. So early 1980s. The first was Paul Benioff at Argonne. Benioff, yeah. Oh, sure.
So, like, this heat dissipated has nothing to do with the resistance in the wires.
No.
Even if you, like, have an entire computer built out of superconducting wires.
Sure.
There's no heat dissipated from.
No, it's a necessary concomitant to irreversible logical operations.
Computer, like let's say, like superconducting wires, we'll never be able to get powerful enough. I mean,
No. You can do your computation reversibly. Bennett showed you can do any computation reversibly, but if you ever have to erase, you'll have to dissipate energy. But anything else, Bennett said that any other computation you want to do that doesn't involve erasure of information can be done reversibly. So,
if you do have supernatural wires, and like how that you could like pack stuff in.
Absolutely. Why not?
That, I mean, if you want to do a irreversible operation.
Oh, see, that's a problem. Then you'll have to be generating heat somewhere, but maybe not much because KT log 2 is not very much. Right at room temperature, that's what 10 to the minus 21st to 20th or joules or something. It's, you know, it's a fraction of an EV, 40th of an EV. So maybe that's not very much, and you're not erasing that much information. You don't want to be erasing a few gigabits per second. That's not much heat. But there will be heat generated if you do erasure. But why erase? Bennett shows that just by keeping around the inputs, you can do any computation. There's a little bit of overhead. You may have to do the computation twice. You can do any amount, any kind of computation you want reversibly. Okay, so that means that the way you design the computation for such a device will be different from the way you would design the computation for a regular machine where you didn't care whether the memory registers got reset or set to zero or something. You'd have to design the computation a little differently. Yeah?
Is it worth it trying to make a reversible computer? Because we have to do a calculation twice, and it's not that much, and it seems like we have sources of it that are much...
Oh yeah, the factor of two in overhead is no big deal. Computer scientists don't mind if it takes you a constant time for the same length. You know, that's the same computational class of computation. The overhead is not so much. The limits are now technological, and there's a fundamental fact that in order to do these things reversibly, typically you need to do them slowly, so that you stay close to thermal equilibrium. That there's a trade-off between doing a nice zippy computation and doing a reversible cool computation. You know, zippy or cool. Yeah.
Don't you at some point have to erase what you've done unless you have like infinite computing power? So at the end of the day, when you turn off the computer, it gets really, really hot.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. Someday you have to reverse, but you have to erase. But the amount of erasure that you have to do may be very small. Okay, like I said, erasing a billion bits will cost you much less than a joule of energy. Okay, so even at room temperature, so maybe that's not a big deal. And you can do that all at the end. You can do it at the end of the day. You go to the erase cycle where your reversible computer sends it over to the erasing machine that gets a little warm. That may be how it would work. The bit bucket is a little warm. Okay. All right. We got to talk about quantum computing because that's why we're here. So there's Paul Benioff, and what Benioff was interested in is thinking about really, really small computational elements. Could you do computation with atomic scale devices? And he said, well, to do that, you're going to have to represent the computation by the dynamical evolution of a quantum system. And he developed some of the basic ideas about how to do that. But Benioff was not thinking that quantum computing was something that was really different from regular computing. It was simply regular computing done in this quantum mechanical way. But that was very cool and very, very inspiring. Then there was also David Deutsch. These two guys are still around, by the way. And Deutsch got interested in quantum computers. As far as I can tell, and I did talk to him about this about 1984. As far as I can tell, he got interested in this because quantum computers were interesting from the point of view of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. Because if you think about it, a quantum computer could be kind of like an observer, especially if it was a really smart quantum computer, an observer, but an observer that functioned quantum mechanically. It would sort of be like Wigner's friend for real. You know Wigner's friend, the one who opens up the box and looks at Schrodinger's cat and joins the superposition of being in the I see the cat alive and I see the cat dead state. Well, a quantum computer, that would make sense. Okay, so that's how he got involved in it. But then he began to find out that quantum computers had some interesting properties that didn't seem to match up to the properties of ordinary computers. And then, of course, there was Richard Feynman. And Feynman's motivation for considering quantum computers is quite interesting, and I want to say a little bit about that. It has to do with the question of using computers to solve physics problems, okay? To simulate the behavior of a quantum system. I want to calculate the behavior of a quantum system. And so what do I need? Well, let's suppose the dimension of my Hilbert, I have one system. The dimension of my Hilbert space is D, and that's the number of complex amplitudes I need to keep track of. Okay? D. In order to track the evolution of the quantum system, I need to track the time-dependent behavior of D complex numbers, the components of this with respect to some basis. Okay, so far so good. But what if I have not one system, but N systems? In other words, I'm not just following one atom, I'm following, 20 atoms, a somewhat bigger quantum system. Well, then the dimension of that Hilbert space, what is that Hilbert space? It's the tensor product of H with itself N times. And the dimension of that is D to the N. And that's the number of complex amplitudes I need to keep track of. Here's the problem. It's exponential in N. The size of the computer I need to calculate the behavior of the quantum system is exponential in the size of the quantum system. To calculate the behavior of one quantum system, I need a computer this big. To calculate the behavior of two quantum systems, I need a computer not twice as big, but the square as big somehow. I wave my hands at that. Okay, that's a problem. Because, you can get fairly small numbers here. Suppose D is 20 and N is 30. Okay? How many complex numbers do you need? Well, it's 20 to the 30th. Which is about 1 times 10 to the 39th. And that's it. It's impractical, totally impractical. Totally impractical. So the problem is that to simulate a quantum system on a classical computer, you need computational resources that grow exponentially with the size of the quantum system. Feynman said, well, the problem is this mismatch between how we're doing the computation and the system involved. What we really need to do is we need to make the physics of the computer a better match to the problem. We need to devise a quantum mechanical computer, and then if I have twice as many memory registers, they'll be the square of the number of states of those memory registers, and I can actually use the computer to kind of simulate the behavior of the quantum system, kind of a universal quantum system simulator device. And the resources that I would need, the size of the computer, scales linearly with the size of the system I'm trying to simulate. So that was Feynman's basic idea, so that was pretty cool. Okay. Then quantum computing really took off in the 1990s when it was discovered that there are lots of mathematical problems which are more efficient to solve if you have a quantum computer than any classical computer could hope to solve. Could do. That is to say, the time it would take or the amount of memory it would take to solve the particular problem grows with the size of the problem much more favorably for a quantum computer than for a classical computer. We'll see at least one example of that, the simplest example, but there are many, and I'll try to mention them. So since the 1990s, and there were also other developments in the 1990s which led us to believe that it wasn't hopeless to build a quantum computer. There are things like quantum error correction, which allow us to fight the effects of the environment by doing just a little bit more computation. You had a question. Exactly. So what Feynman's idea suggested, and he made some good
suggestions about this.
What Feynman's idea suggested is that one of the important things is how you design. Can you simply design the computer, or simply somehow program the computer to do the computation you want? Okay. What would be required for that? And I think that our discussion beginning today will somewhat address that question. Okay, but absolutely right. You're going to have some quantum system that you understand really, really, really well, and that quantum system somehow going to have to be adaptable enough that you can hijack it to simulate this other quantum system with this other Hamiltonian, for example. Yeah.
Very briefly. So basically, there has to be some sort of universal quantum computer.
That was certainly in Feynman's thought. The question of whether there has to be a single one, or whether there's simply a class of them and we can build any one we like, is a different question. But yeah, basically, you want to have one quantum computer that you can program in different ways to simulate different quantum systems. Okay. So let's talk about our computer. Our computer. And you've all seen things like this, I'm sure. It's a collection of qubits. And the qubits are going to be represented by horizontal lines. These guys are qubits. And the lines represent time. The lines represent time. And so the computer operation, the computer operation is some unitary evolution of this set of qubits. So we'll represent it by something like this. Here's a box. Represents some unitary evolution, and here's the input of the computation, here's the output of the computation. And by the way, if I need to read the output, I'm always going to assume that I can make a measurement in the so-called computational basis. That is to say, there's some standard basis, 0 and 1, and I can make a measurement at the end of the qubits in this basis. That's my that's going to be how I read out the how I get the output for myself. Turn it from qubits into something I can publish. Okay, so here's this greatness. There we are, computation, and this isn't very helpful. I just said computation happens here. Okay. For example, this doesn't tell me whether it's hard or easy to do this computation. It doesn't tell me anything about how I might implement this computation. So what am I going to do? What I'm going to do is I'm going to break this unitary operator into pieces. I'm going to break it into pieces that occur successively. So you... in successive pieces. And each piece is simple. In fact, each piece may involve only a few qubits. So, in this picture, in this picture, and I might have lots of inputs and outputs, you know. So, okay, in this picture, it just says, okay, they all interact together somehow. But the pieces I break it up to are going to be somehow relatively simple, easy to specify, and they're only going to involve a few qubits at a time, not the whole smash. And these simple pieces that only involve a few qubits are also known as quantum gates, of course. By analogy to the logic gates that you may have wired up in your electronics course, if you took an electronics course. So these things are sometimes referred to as wires, but it's not quite right. They represent the time evolution of a system. And so, so let's draw a picture here. Let's imagine we have three qubits, okay? And I'll draw some gates. Here's A and here's B. And then maybe we'll do this. Here's C. Okay. And here's D. Okay. So what does this represent? What does this represent? This says, okay, first, A happens on 1, and B happens on 3. Here's 1, 2, and 3 for my qubits here. And B happens on 3, and it actually doesn't matter what order those occur in, or they could happen together, because they commute. They're unitary operators on different systems, for different systems. Then C is some unitary operator that involves both 1 and 2. It's maybe an interaction between them. And then D is a unitary operator involving 2 and 3. So what unitary operator does this represent? Of course, remember, time order is left to right in the diagram, but it's right to left in the operator order. So this unitary operator is D acting on 2, 3, C acting on 1, 2, and then however I like it, you know, B acting on 3, A acting on 1, and these guys commute, so I can put them in any order I want. And that overall, the overall operation that this diagram represents is exactly this one. Exactly this one. Okay, so what I want to do is develop a library, develop a toolbox of simple pieces from which I can build whatever computation I want. And the first type of piece are the single qubit gates. One qubit gates. They look like this. There's some qubit gate. Just and there are various ones of these guys. Let's see. There's the identity. That's represented just by the line here. Okay. We know how the identity works. That means don't do anything. Let's see. Then there's also the Pauli gates, Y and Z. You know, and I'd represent those with little boxes with Y, X, Y, and Z in them. Tell me which ones I did. And let's remember what X is. X is 0, 1 plus 1, 0. And y is the same thing with a minus I in the first one and a plus I in the second one. And z is 0, 0 minus 1, 1. I define these with respect to their identity depends on this computational basis. And of course, these are related. I can write them also as matrix elements, right? I mean, as a matrix of matrix elements. So, you know, x is 0, 1, 1, 0, and y is 0 minus I, 0, and z is 1, 0, 0 minus 1, as matrices. Okay, so these are the Pauli gates, and they're interesting. It's useful to recall various things about the Pauli operators, like The square of any Pauli operator is the identity. So, for example, if I had two x's in a row, that would be just like having nothing. Another one is that's interesting is something like xy. Remember, that was equal to I times z, and then there's, you can get this by cyclically. You can permute this. And that's kind of cool. If I ever need to make z, and all I've got in my toolbox are x's and y's, I can do it by putting an x and a y next to each other. And I get an overall factor of I, but you know, an overall factor is not so bad because that's just an overall factor in the wave function, you know, in the state vector, and an overall phase of the state vector is not so important. Okay? So I can make z's out of x's and y's. And another thing that's kind of useful to remember is something like this. X, y, x is minus y. That's kind of interesting, too. So when you're working with Pauli operators, these kinds of facts are things to keep in mind. Okay, so let's see. I've got 1, 2, 3. I got 4 single qubit gates already. Now I'm going to introduce a whole family of them, an infinite number of them, the so-called phase gate. And I'm going to write it this way. And it depends on a parameter. I've got a parameter here. And I'm going to imagine that this gate has a knob on it. And whatever I set the knob to, it'll be the gate with that parameter. So there's a whole bunch of these guys. And what is the phase gate? Well, the phase gate does nothing to the zero, but it rotates the relative phase of 1 by alpha. So we're plainly unitary. And actually, you can see that the z is just a special case of the phase gate. It's just the phase gate with a pi phase. And we can imagine we can build these guys. Okay, those are useful. And by the way, it's interesting to try to interpret these things as classical gates on a bit. You know, you take the computational basis states to represent the states of a bit, a classical bit, and then x itself is just negation. It changes 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. But the rest of them, and 1 just does nothing. But it's the identity. But the rest of them are a little twisted. They're twisted in phase. This one, the phase gate, twists the phase of 1 relative to 0. The y operator negates and twists the phase in a funny way. So of course, that makes sense. You know that you could sort of build that out of x's and z's using this kind of trick. So some of these guys correspond to classical gates that we somehow are achieving with a unitary operation, so they also work for superpositions. And some of them involve the phases in the computational basis, and that's weird. Yeah.
So the phase gate should be, like, you should be able to compose it of the other ones, right?
Yeah, sure. Right, you're going to be able to put these things together, and we'll talk about ways of doing that. But I want to introduce one more of my favorite, everybody's favorite quantum gate. Here it is. Everybody's favorite, the Hadamard gate. It's named after Jacques Hadamard, the dead French mathematician. As so many things in physics are, it's named after a dead French mathematician. But it's only because that it's related to a mathematical transformation he invented. As far as I know, he never dabbled in quantum computing. A brilliant guy in lots of ways, but anyway. The Hadamard gate. Okay, the Hadamard gate, what does it do? Let me give you the matrix form of it. And I'm, let's see, the matrix form. Right. Don't forget normalization. 1 over the square root of 2 times 1 minus 1. It looks kind of like it's sort of halfway in between an x and a z. Yeah, that's right. And so what does it do? What does this do? Well, if h applies to the zero basis state, you get 1 over the square root of 2 times 0 plus 1. As you can tell by putting in the 1, 0 vector and multiplying this out. And h acting on 1 is 1 over the square root of 2, 0 minus 1. Now, these states I've sometimes called the state plus and minus. They form an alternate set of basis states for the qubit. These are, in fact, what are so-called conjugate basis states, the conjugate basis. A term sometimes used for this. And what the Hadamard gate does is it takes my basis state and turns me into a conjugate basis state. Now, that's interesting. That's interesting. Because, first of all, I want you to note two things. One is that if I do this twice, if I apply H twice, what do I get? What if I have a Hadamard gate followed by another Hadamard gate? What is that? Well, let's see. In matrix representation, that's going to be the product of two of those matrices. So that's 1 half, 1, 1, 1 minus 1, 1, 1, 1 minus 1. And that's equal to 1 half times, let's see, 1 plus 1 is 2, 1 minus 1 is 0, 1 minus 1 is 0, and y, it's 2. Okay, so this is just the identity. So the Hadamard squared is the identity. Like the Pauli gates, it's a gate that if you just did it twice, it's like doing nothing at all. But let's think about the how this works. See, this conjugate basis is kind of interesting. What happens to these conjugate basis states if you apply z to them? Right, exactly. So note that z acting on the plus and minus states is equal to the minus plus states. In other words, z acts as not for the conjugate basis. Z acts as not for the conjugate basis. And so, yeah.
So these are just the basis states for the x.
Yeah, that's right. It's the basis states for x.
So could you go to another conjugate basis that is the basis for the y?
You could, yes. But generally, that's done by the Hadamard's a nice standard piece. Those things certainly are all available. But the Hadamard's really going to show up a lot.
So it's not advantageous to have it there in conjugate basis.
Not advantageous.
Well, I mean, could you think there's a reason we go to the first conjugate basis that we have, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Absolutely. There may be lots of interesting reasons for doing that, but this is going to turn out to be useful for us.
Yeah. Why is your favorite one?
What?
Why H is your favorite?
Oh, it'll become clear in short order, I think. As you'll see, that's foreshadowing. We're going to get a lot of good out of this guy. But allow me to answer the question in due course. Okay, so what this means is that I could, in order to do a negation, I could first take my qubits, I can transform them to the conjugate basis using the Hadamard, I can then do z, which negates them, and then use the Hadamard again to transform them back. In other words, x is equal to hzh. Okay? Which is kind of cool. So if I didn't have any X's in my toolkit, but I had a bunch of Z's and H's, I could make X's. Yeah.
Why is our computing operation unitary?
Why? I'm not quite sure on what level you are asking this question. What do you mean? Why? What do you mean by why? You see, what is our motivation for considering this model? Is it what is the physical cause for the unitarity of the computer?
Is it something that we need? Is the tech table should be unitary so that we are able to compute it?
Ah!
Or
very good.
Just assuming it because it's similar to
very good.
Let's think about different types of computer. We actually talked about this in the first week. If we just had a classical computer, then the classical deterministic computer, that classical deterministic computer goes through one set of computational states, one set of memory states, one trajectory. It does exactly one kind of one computation. It might also be that we had a classical computer that had some randomness in it, so that there are possible different branches of the computation, but to find out the total probability that it would wind up over here, you would have you would have to add up probabilities of various paths. But for a quantum computer to operate, that might operate differently. And the reason it might operate differently is because the different computational paths might interfere with each other. That's the new feature of a quantum computer from the point of view of the computational trajectories. Go back and take a look at that. And that's the new feature. And of course, for that to be true, for the evolution to be linear in the amplitudes, the system must be isolated, therefore evolves unitarily. Okay, so that's why we're considering unitarity. Now we can actually relax that. We can relax that very easily by having some parts of the computer represent the environment, and you unitarily interact with them, and then throw them away. Okay, then you have a more general evolution represented by a completely positive map. So you can generalize this from unitary evolution to sort of any sort of reasonable open system evolution, simply by having parts of the unitary computer that are discarded at the end and traced in. So unitary is sort of the context in which the most power of the quantum computer might appear. And so our question is, if the computer can function in this way, is that any good? That's why everything's unitary. Is that a good answer? Is that answer the version of why that you're asking?
Yes.
You see, yeah. Okay. So, all right. Let me tell you something that will help you understand why I like the Hadamard. Let's imagine that we had a whole bunch of qubits. Let's imagine that I had a whole bunch of qubits, and all the qubits started out as the zero state. So the initial state of this, let me write this very carefully. The initial state is going to be zero tensor product n times. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply the Hadamard gate to each and every one of my qubits. So I started out with a bunch of zeros, and now I apply the Hadamard to them, and I ask the question, what do I get out? What do I get out? Well, let's see. Every one of those zeros has turned into 1 over the square root of 2, 0 plus 1, right? So this is going to be, let's see, 1 over the square root of 2 to the nth power, 1 over 2 to the n over 2, the square root of 1 over 2 to the n, times 0 plus 1 tensor product to the nth power. That's what I'm going to get out, right? See that? Oh, but think about what this includes. This includes a term for every single possible string of zeros and ones, of n-bit string of zeros and ones. This has got 2 to the n terms, and it includes exactly all the combinations of zeros and ones. This tensor to itself n times is 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. And this tensor to itself n minus 1 times, followed by this, is 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. And then, and so on. Every one of them appears. So this is just 1 over 2 to the n over 2 times the sum over A of A, where A is an n-bit string. So what I've got here is a uniform superposition of all the possible qubit basis states. So for example, if I wanted to run a computer on all possible inputs at once, I'd just take my input register, set it up with some zeros, and run it through some Hadamard gates. And voila, with only n operations, which I can do all at the same time if I want to, I produce the superposition that I want. So the Hadamard gate is really useful for building things like this. And it's useful for turning gates of one kind into gates of another kind, as you can see in this relation right here. And by the way, it follows from this, for example, that Z is also equal to HXH. I just multiply both sides at the beginning and the end by H. The H squareds are the identity, so it's all easy. Okay, so much for one qubit gates. There are actually lots more, of course. These will be enough for what I want to do. They form a universal set. I can build any single qubit gate out of the ones I've written down. In fact, I only need the Hadamard and the phase gates. I can build anything out of those. That's related to an interesting fact about interferometers, but that's another story, another day. All right, so now I want to move on. I want to move on, and I want to talk about the next subject, 2-qubit gates. Yeah, there were a lot of 1-qubit gates. There are a lot more 2-qubit gates. I mean, you think about it. D by D unitary matrices are there? Well, infinitely many, of course, but it's a space with D squared real parameters. It's a big space. I'm going to focus my attention on the simplest and most useful of them, the control gates. Controlled gates. So here we've got the control qubit C and the target qubit T. So there are 2 qubits. There are 2 qubits. And the rule is that that I apply some gate, let's call it U, to T if C is 1. There is 1. And otherwise, I do nothing. So this is what I'm thinking. It's not really this, but it's what I'm thinking. Okay? Intuitively, this is what it says. It says, look, check the control bit. And depending on what the control bit is, do the unitary or not. Except, I'm not going to actually make a measurement. I'm going to make this a unitary process. Let me tell you about the controlled U gate, which I just said. It actually can be written this way. Plus, there's just not quite enough room here. 1, 1, tensor U. Okay. This is the gate. This is the gate. This is it. Now, this is unitary. This is unitary. This is a useful exercise. I invite you to show that this is unitary. If you can't show or see very quickly that this is actually a unitary gate for a unitary U, a unitary one qubit gate U gives a unitary gate here, then come see me. Okay. So, but this is unitary. And of course, in this, these guys are the control qubit, and these guys are the target qubit. So in our diagrams, we represent this like this. Here's the control qubit. Here's the target qubit. That's the controlled U. And you know, the idea is that this does U are not controlled by the thing with the dot. Now, the most famous controlled gate is the controlled not. It's the controlled X gate, which is also known as C not, which looks like this. But that's also written, because we fiddle with these a lot, it's also written this way. It's also written this way. And why is it written that way? Good question. Well, let's see how the C-naught gate operates on computational basis states. So we're going to have the control bit and the target bit. And let's suppose that's 0, 0. And this is all under C-naught. What does 0, 0 map to? Well, looking over here, with this being the X operation, the fact that the first qubit is 0 means that this guy makes no contribution, and so this will give me 0 tensor the whatever the state of the target bit was to begin with, and so this is 0, 0. And in, by a similar argument, 0, 1 gives me 0, 1. How about 1, 0? Well, since the first qubit is 1, this term gives me no contribution. This term gives me a 1 tensor, the X operator acting on the second qubit, which is 0. So this goes to 1, 1. And this one, 1, 1, goes to 1, 0. Oh, but notice what's happened. Notice what's happened. This is just like that copying operation we were talking about, isn't it? Oh, it's kind of exactly like it. What this really is A, B going to A, B plus A. That's what this does on basis states. If these are two bits, the C naught takes these basis states to A, B plus A. Okay? Plus modulo 2. Which is why it's drawn this way. This reminds me of that plus modulo 2. It says, oh yeah, A stays A and B is B plus A. I can sort of read it that way. For basis states. There's another way of writing the C naught, and that's in matrix form. And of course, it's an operation on two qubits, so you have a 4x4 matrix. And so people often just write down something like this. Let's see. Okay. So if you write the basis states in this order, then this is the way that the C0 acts on those basis states. But you have to remember to write them in the correct order. So I generally don't work, you can easily work with the matrices, but I generally get confused when I do that. So I often, you know, think of things a little bit higher level. But you can always, any one of these guys, you can think of it as a big matrix. You got n qubits, you got 2 to the n dimensions, and so a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix, that will represent your computation. Okay. Now, this is a funny thing. We've drawn this in terms of the basis states. In terms of the basis states, it looks like this classical operation that we have. And in this classical operation, if you will, the classical C0, in the classical operation, the final state of the first bit, the final state of the first bit, doesn't depend on what the second bit was. But the final state of the second bit depends on what the first state was. And so, you have, if you will, one-way information flow. The information flows from the control to the target, and not vice versa. You have A, B, evolving to A, B plus A, and both of these guys depend on the first guy, but only the second guy depends on the second guy. So there's one-way information flow. The information flow in the classical C0 gate is from the control to the target, and that's that. Hey, that makes sense. You know, that's why you call it control, because you know you set its value and it affects the other guy, and it's, the control doesn't get reset by its interaction with the system, right? With the target. But in fact, this idea is completely wrong. Completely, 100% wrong in quantum mechanics. Not so for the quantum C0. The quantum C0 is something quite different. And so let me just take the last bit of class to tell you this, and this is the tip of a very fascinating iceberg. But we'll get to that presently. Okay, so now, so I want to tell you a few things about C0. C0 is related to control Z. Okay, let me tell you how. That is to say, if I have that control Z is the same as a controlled C0 surrounded by Hadamards on its target. And the reverse is true as well, that if I put Hadamards on the side here, I can get the C0 there. So how do I prove this? How do I prove this? Well, it's actually easier to prove a more general fact. Okay, and what I want to do is I want to consider something that looks like this. In the middle, I'm going to have a controlled U operation. And then I'm going to, on the target bit, have a V operation and its inverse, V dagger. And we'll do V dagger first, and then V. Okay? So what is this? I'm going to argue that that's just a single controlled operation for VUV dagger. Okay, let me prove that. That I can build something like this way. And then the fact about Hadamards follows obviously because HSXH is Z. Okay? Right? So let's work this out. Let's actually write what this is. This represents, let's see, it's going to be a sequence of things. There's going to be one for the control tensor V for the target. That's this guy. And then the next thing is going to be the controlled operation, which is 0 for the control tensor identity for the target, plus 1 for the control tensor U for the target. And then there's going to be identity tensor V dagger. That's what this diagram represents. And of course, there's just going to be two terms. There's going to be the term composed of this product and the term composed of this product. The sum in the middle gives me two terms. And the products of operators are very easy for tensor product operators. And so what do I get? I get 1 times 0 times 1, which gives me 0 tensor V times 1 times V dagger, V dagger, plus 1, because that's 1 times 1, sorry, 1 times a projection onto 1 times the identity, tensor, the product of these guys, VU V dagger. But of course, VV dagger is the identity, and so this gives us 0 tensor the identity plus 1 tensor VU V dagger, which is exactly right. So this is true. And therefore, this is true. Okay? Now, here's the second thing I want to tell you about. Control Z really makes no distinction between the target and the control. There's no distinction between C and T for the controlled Z operation. I mean, let's think about it. What I'm claiming is that this operation is exactly the same as this operation. That these are the same. Control and target are really the same. And how does that work out? Well, let's take a look at what this guy does. This guy takes 0, 0 and maps it to what? Well, it doesn't do anything because the control bit's 0. And the same for 0, 1. The control bit's 0. What about 1, 0? Well, what is this says apply the Z operator to the second guy. But what does the Z operator do when you apply it to 0? Doesn't do anything. So it's 1, 0. How about 1, 1? Now the Z operator switches the phase. You pick up a minus sign, so this goes to -1, 1. This is completely symmetric in the two qubits. These two things are both this operation. And if I tell you how the operator works on a basis, I've told you everything. So these two things are the same. For the controlled Z operation, there is no distinction between the control being this qubit and the control being that qubit. The control Z operation is completely symmetric between the two qubits. And of course, you see where this is going. Okay. Let's imagine that I had something that looked like this. I did the controlled Z op. I did the controlled not operation, but I put Hadamards before and after both qubits. And what am I basically doing? Basically, what I'm doing is I'm transforming to the conjugate basis before, and then transforming back afterwards. So let's take a look at this guy and see what he is. Okay. If the classical ideas were right, if there was one-way information flow from control to target, then there should also be one-way information flow from control to target here, right? Because I just messed with the control a bit before and after, and the target a little bit before and after, but that shouldn't change the fact that the only information flow is from control to target, right? But of course, you see how this is going to work out. If I take the Hadamard before and after C naught, I'll get a controlled Z operation. So let's see, I've got Hadamard still up top, and then I have a controlled Z acting. But of course, there's no distinction between controlled Z one way and controlled Z the other. So I've got Hadamard, and I've got a Z Hadamard, that Z is controlled by the bottom guy. Oh, yeah. Remember I said that I could do the same thing in reverse by putting some more Hadamards on this. So what's this? Yeah, C naught in reverse. It's C naught in reverse. So here, I really would like to say, because I've been thinking classically, that there's one-way information flow that way. Here, I really want to say there's one-way information flow that way. The moral of the story is there's no one-way information flow in the C naught. The C naught has to be thought of as an interaction that can potentially allow information to go both ways. You can be fooled by just looking at the basis vectors. If you look at the action of the C naught in the conjugate basis, you actually get a C naught going the other way. Now, this is a special case of a general theorem about interactions in quantum mechanics. And so at the beginning of class next time, I will prove this general theorem, which can be thought of as an extension of the isolation theorem. And that's how we'll prove it. Which will show that this lesson about C naught is a completely general lesson. And so that's worthwhile. It's always worthwhile to learn something completely general. And then we'll go off and build more complicated quantum computers. That'll be on next time, which is Thursday. Questions? Okay. We'll see you then.